Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
All right, sir, whenever you're ready, anything that you want to say.
All right. Now, you tell. I made some notes, but you tell me if they're what you need or maybe what you do not need. You just stop me if I get into an area that's not something you want. Okay?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I enlisted in the Marine Corps on February 10th, 1943. I was 18 and a half years old. I was discharged on January 4th, 1946, with a Purple Heart, having been wounded on Iwo Jima. My training consisted of initially at Parris Island in South Carolina. From there, I was sent to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina and put into an engineering company and eventually was assigned to Camp Pendleton in California as part of a demolition squad. Now, I can tell you, if you would like to know what the job is of a demolition squad.
Absolutely. We would love to hear what you did.
Okay. First of all, a demolition squad is usually made up of a flamethrower and machine guns and various explosives. There are such things as known as a satchel charge, which is a pack of clay. Well, it looks like clay. It was called C2. It's a kind of an explosive. It was the job. It was my job to carry a satchel charge, and to see that it was used to blow up caves and bunkers and pillboxes. The flamethrower was to protect, to close the apertures of the pillboxes so that I could approach and anybody else could approach and get the satchel charge into the pillbox to destroy the pillbox. We also carried what was known as a Bangalore torpedo, which was a long pipe with explosives and was used to blow up barbed wire. We carried maybe five or six of them, so it was a long way off. We could connect them and then blow up a path to get into the closer to the pillbox. That basically tells you, of course, that we were receiving cover from other men in the demolition squad who carried grenades and they carried machine guns to keep the Japs pinned down while we approached the pillbox. From Camp Pendleton, I'm going on from there. My first stop, stop me if you want to.
No, you're doing great, sir. Thank you.
My first operation was in the Marshall Islands. That was the initial operation for the 4th Division, which I was a member of. And I happened to be a member of the 4th Engineer Battalion, A Company. The operation took place in the Marshall Atoll, where there were many small islands and one fairly good-sized island with an airfield. I spent 8 hours. That was the first invasion I made. I spent 8 hours in an amphibious tractor before we could land on that small island that we were assigned to. And I remember I got deathly sick from being in that tractor. And I had a friend, a very good friend, who saved two or three people in other tractors because the swells were so bad that they they swamped some tractors and men were thrown into the water, and he jumped out and saved some. I noticed that I had never done anything more than a firecracker in my life, and here I was carrying in my breast pocket a, oh, wait a minute, it came out, a 4x8 piece of plywood that was an inch thick. In there were 8 holes, and the reason for carrying that was I carried the detonating caps in that would be used to explode the charges, and they were, you could set them off with the heat of your hand. They were so fragile, so they taught me to drill holes aboard ship and in plywood and slip these things, which were like a thin pencil, into this plywood. I carried it in, and we were fortunate. The little island that we landed on had very few Japs, and I went in, I guess it was the third wave, and most of the problem there was that the third wave started firing on what they thought was few Japs on the island that happened to be the guys in the first wave. Huh. That was the what happens with inexperience. That was our first operation. Now, I saw something that I don't know how to explain it to you. You can take it out of this if you want. So print what you want. Imagine a 19-year-old kid hitting a beach, scared to death, and the few Japs that he saw had their penises cut off and stuck in their mouths. Can you imagine that?
That's a heck of a sight.
Yeah.
That's wild.
The crazy Marines, I guess whatever, there were nutty Marines and whatever. All I can say is that's something I wouldn't have done, but it jarred me. They were mutilated. And that operation lasted a couple of hours, and the island was secure. And they still had trouble on the larger island, where the larger island was called Badio, and that island suffered 737 casualties. I don't think we suffered more than a dozen casualties on that little island we're on. It was over in no time. I wouldn't call that a major operation, except that 737 guys were killed and wounded on one of the other islands in the atoll. I returned to Maui. Unfortunately, I should say before that, the few Japs that were captured on Badio, I noticed in a picture that I saw later, they were stripped. They only had loincloths on. And the reason for that is the Japs would put grenades in their loincloths, and when you captured them, they would explode the grenade, mm-hmm. so they could kill you as well as themselves. Well, most of the men that in my company and a few others, for whatever reason, we got sick. We came down with dysentery, and we were sent back to the Hawaiian Islands into what was known as Aiea Heights Hospital, and we recuperated there. I don't know if you know what dysentery is.
Right, it was really common in the World War II. I mean, in Guadalcanal, John Bassalone's platoon got it as well.
Yeah, and after we left the hospital, we went back to our base, which was Maui in the Hawaiian Islands, a beautiful island. It's probably one of the greatest resorts right now. We were preparing to get ready to go to Saipan. When we went to Saipan, we stopped at Pearl Harbor for whatever reason. I was on an LST. I don't know if you know what an LST is. Landing ship tank, which had a big, I don't know how you would describe it. It was almost like a ship that could carry in its hold 10 or 12 or 15 amphibious tractors. And when they reached the beach, they would open the doors on that ship, and the tractors would roll out, and we were in the tractors. So that the amphibious, the LST was a slow-moving 10 knots an hour but it carried enough tractors with enough men so that it made an impression on what, you know, instead of a lot of what we called Higgins boats, which mm-hmm. were different. Well, when we got to Pearl Harbor on our way to Saipan, I remember it was like Christmas, and we were sitting in a row. There must have been 6 or 8 LSTs lined up. And about midnight, there was an explosion in one of the LSTs. No one ever read about this in the newspaper. It just never came out. What had happened was they were welding something, and a spark got into some of the munitions, and it blew the hell out of one or two of the LSTs. The guys were jumping. This was in the Pearl Harbor before they even got to Saipan. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, we lost some men there. But then we slowly went across to Saipan. Saipan is a rather large island, mountainous, trees. Contrary to what a lot of people knew of islands, it was not flat. It was mountainous as could be. I was on an amphibious tractor there, and we received fire coming into the beach, which we did not receive at the Marshall Islands. The 16-inch guns on the battleships, which we sailed under on our way to the beach, you could hear those shells. They sounded like a freight train going overhead. The first night, we landed on the beach. We didn't lose too many on a first night, except first day, I should say. We didn't get our tractor hit. Some did get hit. The first night, I spent in a foxhole with an old buddy of mine. We were about 50 yards inland. And then about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, when it got dark, we started getting a lot of shelling around the foxhole. We got mortar shells and artillery shells. And unfortunately, when the morning came, we found that some of our men in foxholes had been cut up because the Japanese officers carried swords. And if you weren't awake, you could get your head half cut off. But we moved on a little at a time, and we got to a spot. I bring this up because it's notable. Got to a spot about, second or third day, where there was an incline and then a drop-off. And there was a pillbox down below, and we were assigned to get the pillbox knocked out. We had a young lieutenant, and he and 2 or 3 guys went down. The rest of us stayed back a ways. And as he got down, he was hit in the head by a sniper. And the 2 guys that were with him carried him back up to where we were. The 2 men that carried him up were also friends of mine. They were put up for an award, but I don't think they ever... when you go to court, what is it? I forget what you call it. I was called by... many years later to find out exactly what happened so that these men could receive the award, but it never materialized. I also got to a point about 10 days later. We moved very slowly. It was a big island, and I was looking for a friend of mine from my hometown, and I got to his outfit that we were going to relieve, and I found that he had been killed about an hour before I got there. We moved on the island, and I remember a specific day, we landed, I think it was June 15th, but by July 4th, we had set up a line across the island. There was the 2nd Division, the 27th Army, and the 4th Division straight across the island, and I remember the 4th, it was very dark, and I was in a foxhole with another friend of mine, a big young guy from Philadelphia. He was about 6'2", He must have weighed 220 pounds. And we shared a foxhole that night, July 4th. And as we sat there, we naturally, you're afraid to go to sleep. He and I were sitting back to back, so he could watch one way and I could watch the other.
Sure.
All of a sudden, I felt him shaking. And I turned around. And I said, "Stan, what's the matter?" He says, "It's cold." It was about 85 degrees. But before you know it, I was shaking. There were two guys scared to death. And they could hear the Japs, which were not far away, yelling, "Marine, you die tonight." We unfortunately, one of our sergeants, who was an old policeman from New York, he was probably one of the oldest guys in the company, challenged some Japs coming up the road, and they said, "Who goes there?" And they killed him. They shot him. Of course, they got those Japs, but unfortunately, he lost his life. I'm just looking. We moved on to approaching the end of the island. I might tell you this is an incident you probably wouldn't hear about in the records. As I mentioned, there were three divisions lined up across the island. We were told that we were going to jump off at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, a massive attack all across the width of the island with three divisions. As it turned out, the artillery preceded the attack, and then the artillery in front of my division stopped. They had bombarded what they thought was sufficiently. And we jumped off. The second division jumped off too. But I know you guys were in the Army, so don't take any.
Oh, no,
any
no, 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 sir. I'm a Marine.
He was a Marine. Oh, yeah. I was in the Army, sir.
Okay. So the only thing I can tell you is that you saw two Marine divisions moving out, and the Army didn't move. And the reason was, we found out later, that there was a General Smith was in command of the Army, and the overall command of the operation on Saipan was an old Marine named Howlin' Mad Smith. So they had two Smiths. And he didn't jump off when he should have. So we had our flanks. We jumped off, and we had our flanks open on either side because the middle was open. Well, General Smith, Howlin' Mad, relieved the Army general right on the spot. You don't hear that too often.
No, you don't.
And he relieved him, and you never read much about that in the history books, but that's something that took place. Well, we got to close to near the end of the island. There's a rather, I don't say it's famous, the end of the island was like a cliff, maybe a drop-off of 300 or 400 feet into the water. And the Japs were just about what was ever left of them, plus a lot of Korean slaves. The Japs had a lot of Korean slaves, men, women, and children, that they used for the sugar mills that they had on Saipan. And they had them, they were all pushed back towards the end of the island. Maybe we were a 1,000 yards below, before the end. And we started shelling, because shelling the Japs at the end. But we knew they had very few artillery pieces left. So to show you how clever they were, when we started shelling, they started shelling, but they didn't hit us. They would drop their shells right in front of us or slightly behind us. And we'd get on the phone and call the guy in the back, "Knock off the shelling, you're landing short." And that's exactly what they wanted, because they couldn't compete with us. Eventually, we knocked out whatever artillery they had. And then a very sad incident took place, which became rather famous for pictures during the war. They showed all these Korean people jumping off the end of the cliff because they were told the Marines were going to rape them. So there were hundreds of men, women, and children that jumped off the cliff into the water, literally committing suicide because they were afraid the Marines were going to rape them. That place was known as Marapi Point, but it was a terrible, things to see. Well, we finished with Saipan, and the Saipan casualties, I'll just give you an idea. We were on the island 35 days, and the casualties were wounded and killed almost 6,000. Wow. And then we got ready for Tinian, which was right across the bay, maybe a mile away, was a smaller island called Tinian. I don't know if you ever heard of it. That's where the B-29s flew off to bomb Japan. So we just didn't even get on a ship. We got into tractors, and we rode across the bay to get to Tinian. Well, the generals were smart. Tinian was not nearly as big as Saipan. It had a town that was called Tinian Town, and what they did is they sent a lot of cargo ships right opposite Tinian Town so that the Japs would assume we were going to land there. Instead, we landed in the other side of the island where there was only a beach, which was unusual for a landing, of maybe 100 yards. No one ever lands on a 100-yard beach. It's crazy.
Yep.
But the ruse worked because it wasn't that heavily defended, except as my amphibious tractor landed next to another one. They couldn't land more than one or two. It was so narrow. Mm-hmm. The other tractor hit a mine. Now, it was not an ordinary landmine. It was a heavy bell line that they use in the water. And it picked up that tractor, literally, I don't know if you know what amphibious tractors, literally picked it up out of the water and bent it in half and killed everybody that was in it. But we landed there, and we didn't have any opposition because the Japs were expecting us on the other side of the island. Mm-hmm. Well, that first night, I guess they recovered and realized what had happened, and we had a banzai attack, which is often misinterpreted. They just come at you. It can scare the hell out of you, but it gives you a chance if you got enough people to kill an awful lot of Japs because sure. they just come in waves. Well, we got through that, and we moved pretty well after that because the island was not as heavily defended as Saipan. We lost 2,000 men on that island. Now, at the end of the island, something took place that we had never seen before. That was the first time we saw napalm used, dropped. I don't know if you know what napalm is.
Yeah. Sure.
And it was dropped at the end of the island, and I guess whatever was left there, that was the end of Saipan. And it was secured. It didn't take long. I think it took 4, 5, 6 days to secure the island as opposed to Saipan. And we were put back in aboard ship and sent back to Maui to refurbish our supplies and the guys that got hurt and whatever, and to train again. We didn't know where we were going again anymore. So we got aboard ship. I don't recall this being, my memory fazed me a little on this, whether it was a LST or a regular transport. I'm inclined to think it was a transport. And we sailed for what we didn't know at the time until we got way out in the ocean. We were told we were going to hit a tiny little island. It was about 10 square miles. It was called Iwo Jima. And we were told that it was heavily fortified, but that the battle should take no more than 5 or 6 days. And the Air Force from Saipan, where Antinian had been bombing Iwo, you can imagine 10 square miles. Sure. It's all it was, like 5, 6 by 2. And they had been bombing it day after day after with B-29s and whatnot and naval aircraft. So we assumed that island wouldn't even be there when we got there. Mm-hmm. It would probably sink. Well, as you know, it didn't sink. And we got there in the morning, and I never saw so many battleships and destroyers and every kind of ship you could think of, from rocket-throwing, firing ships to whatever. They were called LCIs. And that island was all smoke because it was being heavily bombarded by the ships as well as naval aircraft. Well, three or four or five waves, there were two divisions that landed. There was the 5th Division that landed on the left where the mount was. You know, heard of Mount Suribachi.
Sure.
And then my division, the 4th, landed on the right. So we had two divisions landing. The 3rd Division was in reserve. Well, for some reason, after three or four waves landed, quite a few men, the Japs didn't even open fire. They didn't open fire on anybody coming in on that beach. For whatever reason, I don't know how it happened, my landing craft, which landed later, maybe an hour, two, or three after the initial landings, we were the only landing craft in the wave across the whole width of that. It was quite long. Mm-hmm. We were lucky. We weren't fired on. What the Japs did is let I forgot his name. Maybe it was Kuribachi was the name of the general. He let the Marines, you know, he had a lot of experience. He let the Marines land and congregate on the beaches. So there were thousands of Marines on the beach and Amtraks and all kinds of equipment. Then when the beach was loaded, they opened up and they didn't have to aim. They had everything zeroed in. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, it was only 10 square miles. And they dropped what was known as spigot mortars, which were big, big mortars. They couldn't aim them, except they just shoot them towards the beach, plus artillery, and they wreaked havoc on the beach that first day because it was so loaded. That first night, I and part of my company, by the way, I was very lucky. When I got off the landing craft, for whatever reason, dropped off in the water, it didn't go up onto the beach because I guess they have a motor. So they thought that before they could get stuck in the sand, they stopped somewhat out further from the beach. And I had carrying each Marine didn't have a vest. They had not a life preserver, mm-hmm. but what amounted to a preserver, I don't know what you would call it, that you wore around your waist. And if you squeezed it, it would inflate, and that would act as, if you got knocked off into the water, that would act as a life preserver. It wasn't much of a life preserver. But as it turned out, we got off, and as I dropped off that landing craft, I'm 5'5". Well, we were in about 6 foot of water. And I was carrying my rifle and a knapsack, and I probably, if I recall, had a Bangalore torpedo. We each had to carry something in.
And you had an M1 Garand, right?
Yes, I had an M1.
And how heavy was your backpack with the claymores in it?
Not too bad. It was the equipment more. But what happened to me was that as I dropped into the water and I sank, I squeezed this belt, and it inflated and pushed up on my chest, so I could hardly breathe. Bad enough, I was almost underwater. I couldn't breathe at all. Even when I came up, I couldn't breathe. I probably would have laid there and drowned, except that someone, to this day, I don't know who it was, came up behind me, grabbed the back of that life preserver, or whatever you want to call it, and dragged me into the beach where I could stand. So I got up on the beach, and that first night was a night of all the combat that I was in was the worst. The beach is sandy, and it rises up slightly. And it was so loaded, we hadn't moved because the Japs, after, as I say, after we got on the beach, they started shelling. So we couldn't move very well initially. So we dug in on the beach that night, dug a foxhole. If you dig deep enough, you could feel the heat. It was a volcanic island, mm-hmm. and deep enough, you could feel that it was warm. So I dug in. I just happened to be that night by myself, but it was surrounded by other guys in my outfit that did the same thing, and we figured we'd dig in and just hope. But they opened up even worse, and I remember laying there, and the shells started landing all around me. My face was in the sand. The helmet would pop off and on from the concussion. It was getting that close. I said, pretty soon they're going to land one on me. So for whatever reason, I don't know why, I got up and I ran down the beach to my left, maybe 50, 60, 70 yards. I just ran to get the hell out of there. Mm-hmm. And I found an area where it wasn't my company, it was another, but they were lucky. Their spot wasn't being hit. So for whatever reason, I got through the night, and I knew I had to go back to where my outfit was. I went back, and what I saw was unbelievable. We lost a slew of guys. They were killed. They were mutilated from the shelling. If I hadn't gotten out of there, I don't know, I could have been, you know, I could have been one of them. But I guess I was lucky. We moved on the next day. And the job that my outfit was given was to probe in front of tanks. We got some tanks on shore to see if there were mines in front of the tanks. Mm-hmm. Now, a tank going up, and there's no trees or anything on Iwo. It's shrubs. It's like open, almost like a desert.
And can you tell us a little bit about what the sand was at? Because I've been to Iwo, and it's really thick, and it's hard to walk in without anything, without bombs going off everywhere. It's really thick sand.
But if you dig a hole, sometimes it would slide back in. It's hard to dig a hole. And as we moved up off the beach, and we were told to get in front of the tank, as I say, with bayonets and probe for mines, I don't know whatever got me and a couple of other guys. We said, this is not for us. We got behind.
That was smart.
We got behind the tanks instead of in front of the tanks.
Well, I guess we did find it first.
Yeah. Well, the tank was a natural target for the Japs. That's the first thing they're going to go for, to hit a tank. Mm-hmm. Well, we were lucky. They hit some tanks, but we survived. And little by little, we moved very little. It was tough. A lot of guys got killed, and we blew some pillboxes. And then, I don't know when it was, I was on the island for, I think I wrote it down, I think was on the island for about 19 days. But that's how slow, and we still hadn't gotten nearly to the end. That's how slow it was. We took two airfields. The 3rd Division and part of the 5th Division took the airfields, and the 4th was on the right-hand side, and we moved through some tough territory. Got to a spot where there was a pillbox, and actually that was our job, to get the pillbox out of there. So we were attached, each company of engineers was attached to a regiment of infantry, and then they broke it down either further. A squad was attached to a company, and so on. So each infantry company had a squad of engineers to do the demolition work. Well, we got to, and they would, if when we cleared out a pillbox, it was their job to advance. Well, we were attacking a pillbox, a cave, not a pillbox, and I had a satchel charge, and I prepared it with a fuse and a fuse lighter and the satchel charge, and I got it. And what the Japs would often do, if you threw it into a cave, and there were caves all over. If you've been to Iwo, you heard about it.
Right.
There was caves underground like a city. Mm-hmm. And if you threw a satchel charge into a cave, they'd throw it back out. So I got to this place where I threw the satchel charge into the cave, and I figured I'd wait to see if they threw it out. Then I said, I better get the hell out of there. It's going to go off. Mm-hmm. So I turned around and I took off. And as I took off, it blew. But the concussion hit me. Lucky I wasn't, you know, more than 2 or 3 feet away. It would have killed me. But the concussion fractured the third lumbar vertebrae in my back. So I went down. They got me out of there. And I was taken to an aid station and put aboard. They had 2 or 3 hospital ships. They were so full of casualties and whatnot that they had to use a destroyer to take wounded aboard, at least temporarily. So I was taken aboard a destroyer along with some other casualties. And a humorous thing, if you want to call it, that happened. When the sailors saw us, when they brought us aboard the destroyer, the sailors were wonderful. You know, we were something. They were safe, literally. And here we were, a bunch of dirty old Marines, had just got out of combat. And the first thing they asked us, do we have any flags? They wanted souvenirs. Oh, I heard a story.
Typical
where
Navy.
I heard a story where one of these enterprising Marines somehow later painted red circles on a silk thing, and was selling them as souvenirs of flags.
Very nice.
The Marines are enterprising. Well, from there they got me aboard a transport, and I was taken back. Strangely enough, that transport took, along with a lot of the hospital ships, went back to Saipan, which we had taken previously, mm-hmm. and that by now had been fixed up with, you know, reasonably secure hospitals and things of that nature, so they could take care of the casualties from Iwo. And well, I was spent some time there in the hospital on Saipan, and then eventually I was put on a transport and went back to Hawaii. Still, all I knew is that I had a terrible back, but I didn't know what really was wrong with me. I got back to not Maui, but Oahu, and there was a big naval hospital called Aiea Heights Hospital on Oahu, and they took me in, x-rayed me, and they found that I had a fractured a third lumbar vertebrae in my back, but the doctor told me by that time it had almost healed.
Oh, wow.
So he said, he looked at me, I guess, I don't remember who he was or what, but he looked at me, he says, where you been? I said, the Marshall, Saipan, Tinian. Well, he says, you've seen enough, I'm going to send you home. Well, I could have got up and kissed this guy. I eventually got sent back on a ship to Seattle, which was beautiful, and I spent some time in a hospital there in Seattle, and then we were used to, strangely enough, in a parade in Seattle to raise funds. They were raising, you know, war bonds, and they had 4 or 5 of us Marines who were wounded on Iwo get up on a stage and tell people.
So you must have been a real looker in your day, because I know they only had the real handsome guy selling war bonds. No. You must have been a real looker.
Yeah, 5'5".
Yeah, I've read enough books to know that they only had the real handsome Marines out there selling the war bonds.
And then we went from there. They sent us by train to New York, to Coney Island. I don't know if you ever heard of Coney Island.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
In New York.
Get you a nice hot dog.
Yeah, where they had a famous hotel called the Half Moon Hotel, which was turned into a naval convalescent hospital. But oddly enough, on the train, I don't know how I managed to get work. The train went across the country, so it didn't move too fast. Somehow I got word to a cousin of mine that lived in Mansfield, Ohio, and the train went through Mansfield, Ohio, and she was standing on the station. I couldn't get off, and she couldn't get on. and I saw her. And she stood by the window as I sat by the window, and I told her to call my father in Newark. I was from Irvington. Mm-hmm. So she, I don't know if you know, heard of Irvington.
Sure, I'm from New Jersey myself. I'm from Plainfield, so I know Irvington.
Oh, so as it turned out, the train slowly proceeded, and my father got word when the train was going to pull into Penn Station in Newark. And as it pulled in, they stopped, and, you know, they opened the doors on the train. There was my father. And he gave me a big, that's the first time I saw him in almost 2.5 years.
Wow.
And he gave me a big hug, but I couldn't get off the train. I had to go on to Seagate. And there I spent a while. And it was from there that I was discharged. And, of course, I went home. And that was the end. I'll give you an idea of two things. First of all, let me get my notes here. I understand one of you guys served in Iraq.
We both did, sir.
Both were
you
in Iraq.
Did.
Yes, sir.
I don't envy you, first of all, because half the time you didn't know who the enemy was, I guess. I don't know how it was. And as far as these improvised things that they had in the ground, mm-hmm. that's enough to scare anybody. But I'll give you, and I know you. We lost a lot of men in Iraq and, of course, in
Afghanistan.
But I'll give you an idea about what the casualty was for one division in the three. Let me look here. The casualties for my division. Wait a minute, I'll get it. The casualties for the 4th Division, and it took about, I don't know, it must have took about 4 or 5 weeks, to, as small as it was, to secure that island. The casualties for the 4th Division were over 9,000, and that was without the casualties in the 3rd and the 5th Division. The total, I've been led to believe, if I'm correct, the casualties came between 25 and 28,000 just for the Battle of Iwo. My division lost in the 4 battles that we fought. We lost almost 18,000 killed and wounded. So I'm not saying I wouldn't want to have been with you two guys, but when you think of the rate of the casualties for the time spent on these islands, it was pretty fierce.
Oh, there's no comparison. And me being a Marine, while we have you on, I just want to say thank you so much, because everybody that thinks that I'm tough because I'm a Marine was built on the backbone of what you did in the Pacific Islands, and you rattled off the 4 islands that you were on like they were no big deal, but we still learn about the islands that you fought on at boot camp. We scream them at night, and we...
And there were, these were not the... Don't forget, Peleliu and Tarawa were terrible battles, but I think the worst battle for the amount of time and the casualties was Iwo, and you would think 10 square miles... And we probably landed with, 70,000 men. We had 3 divisions and replacements and whatnot. And the Japs had 25 or 30,000 on that little island. So you can imagine the fighting that took place in 10 square miles. So that's my story. I'll tell you later on when I went to college. My mother made me go to college.
Good woman.
And I had the first, I don't know, it's the first or second class I was in. The professor asked us to prepare a term paper. What the hell did I know? I was at a high school. I don't remember term papers from high school.
You should have just said, I was on Iwo Jima. That's my term paper.
Well, I couldn't think of anything. So I wrote a term paper on why we took Iwo Jima.
Oh, wow.
And as it turned out, Iwo Jima was taken for several reasons. It was argued whether it was worth it with all the loss of life, but it saved a lot of lives because when the B-29s flew out of Saipan and Tinian, they were attacked by Japanese fighters near Iwo. They had to fly near Iwo to get to Japan. Mm-hmm. And they knocked down loads of them, and there were a lot of guys got killed on their way to Iwo. Then when they got to Japan and they bombed, this was before the bomb, they dropped a lot of fire bombs and they lit up Tokyo. And of course they caught anti-aircraft fire and a lot of ships on their way back. Many of them couldn't make it back to Saipan. So if they didn't get ditched in the water, they could land halfway at Iwo, which we had two airfields. And there were many B-29s that landed at Iwo or around Iwo, where the men's lives, thousands of lives of flyers, were saved because of that island. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons why they took it. And of course, if we had Iwo on their way back, if they were fortunate to be in good shape, they didn't have to worry about the Japs in Iwo shooting them at them while they were on their way back to Saipan. So that's why we took Iwo. And that's, I don't know what else I can tell you. I have a few little stories I'll tell you, and then I'm finished. There are things that happened that I wasn't exactly part of. I remember when we were on Saipan at night, they were using people to bring supplies up. I don't know why they sent them up at night, because I guess we were short of ammunition or whatever. Because no one wants to move around at night. And because if you're sitting in a foxhole and you're looking out and you hear Japs, and you could swear every tree is moving and everything out there is alive, because your eyes play tricks with you. And after a while, you see something. And I heard the story. It didn't happen to me, but a couple of Marines saw somebody out there and they heard somebody approaching. They said, "Halt, who goes there?" No, nothing. Mm-hmm. Again, who goes there? Nothing. Finally, either who goes there or I'm going to open fire. Well, the poor guys that were carrying the supplies didn't know the password. The password was a month of the year. So finally, you hear these guys say that are bringing the supplies. You hear them say April, May, June, July, August, and September. they couldn't remember the password. They were so scared. Those are little things that happen. I was very lucky. I was very lucky. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you mentioned, you know, quite a lot that you were a part of, and I could tell you served with a lot of great men. Is there anything that really sticks out for you that you remember most about all the great men that you served with?
Yes. Particularly the one kid when you're with a group of men, you're in a company or a platoon, you become friendly. You may know everybody in the platoon, but you're generally four, five, six guys are close. I would assume it happened in where you were too. I don't
Absolutely.
Know. Yeah. Yeah. So I had four or five good friends. There's not one of them of those four or five that are alive. The last one was, he didn't make it to Iwo. He was lucky. He got a V-12 chance to go back to the States and become an officer. I met him in Florida years ago, but he has since passed away. And the one kid I spent the first night with on Saipan was an engineer from West Virginia. He had just recently passed. But the guy that I remember the most was this young fellow, very sensitive young man, probably my age, from New Hampshire, who was with me in, as I told you, in the first landing in the Marshalls, when he jumped over the side of our tractor and pulled two guys out of the water. Mm-hmm. That from a tractor that had been swamped. He saved two lives right there. Then the other thing is when he carried out, he went down when with the lieutenant and got hit. He got hit in the head. His whole head was split open. He carried him under fire away from that spot and brought him to the aid station where they weren't gonna let him, as much as said he'll never make it, but somehow he made it, and they got him back to St. Albans Hospital in Long Island. And I'm not sure, my mind's cloudy, if I went to see him, but he died at the hospital. But that young fellow, later on, after this was on Saipan, as we got near the end of the island, he got killed, which broke my heart, because he was a very sensitive, quiet guy, had a lot of balls, believe me. Mm. And he was, I always think about him. His name was Bob Davies. And I think that one of the guys after the war, I don't know if it was the guy that went to the V-12 program, I think he got up to New Hampshire and met his family. For whatever reason, I never got there. But I'm sorry that I didn't. But he was an example of if you want to talk about a guy that was really heroic and had a lot of guts, it was Bob Davies. There were a lot of other guys, but he was a close friend of mine. And you lose a close friend, it's tough. What else can I tell you, fellas?
Now, one question that I wanted to ask you is, being in the most iconic battle in Marine Corps history, and when you're on your way back to Hawaii after you injured your back,
yeah,
how long did it take you to kind of adjust after seeing what you saw there? What was your mental state? Did you get much sleep? Did it torture you for years?
Yeah, I guess maybe because I was so happy to be alive and get out of there with all my body parts, even though I ached. When I got home, I became a disabled. I got a disability because of my back. But when I got home, I was with my family, my mother, my father, my sister, and some of the guys that had come back from Europe, from World War II. So I had some sleepless nights, but I don't recall. And we started to drink a little bit more than we used to. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall having what I read about these poor kids that come back from Afghanistan with what you referred to as, I guess what you're talking about is, we called it combat fatigue.
Right, or sure. Shell shock.
Yeah. Now it's called, what is PTSD. It referred? Right. I was lucky. My wife still says I get up some night with yelling, but it's not what I think these poor kids that suffer from what you just said. I don't think I have that. If anything, the experience strengthened me in a lot of ways, because I had some tough times after it. I became a school principal, and my wife got sick. She has cancer, and I lost a grandson that broke my heart. So the Marine Corps helped strengthen me in some ways, because I said if I could survive that, I could survive a lot of other things. But to suffer other than some bad dreams, I guess I can't say that I did. In fact, the injury that I suffered, even though it caused me some grief, I wound up, what helped me a great deal is I played a lot of ball. I love to play ball. I played ball in college, baseball.
Your grandson sent me the picture of you still pitching now.
Yeah, and I played baseball and softball, and I loved it. And I played until I was 70 years old. I didn't play with the young guys, but I played till I was 70. And the thing that kept my mind to this day, I think at 92, I still have a pretty active mind. I forget certain things, but I worked after I retired as a school principal after 36 years. I worked in Catholic schools mainly in Jersey City and many other towns in New Jersey as a part-time social worker, as part of a child study team. Child study team is made up of a social worker, a psychologist, and a learning consultant. And we work with kids that are having problems and their families. So I probably worked in every, we worked for a company that was received the contract from the Diocese of Newark, which included Jersey City and a lot of other towns. Mm-hmm. I worked in maybe 10 towns, but mainly Jersey City. I probably worked in every Catholic school in Jersey City. But what that did for me is keep my mind occupied. The last time I worked, and I stopped, I guess, because the company lost the contract, I was 85 years old. So I worked all those years until I was 85. I retired when public school was 64, so I worked almost 20 years as a social worker in Catholic schools, and that's what kept my mind active. And I think to this day, that helped me, you know, keep what I've got.
So I mean, you're doing amazing. Like, to go through that and have your notes, and incredible.
Well, that's my story. I got two great grandsons. I got a wife that's a wonderful person. She's, you know, she's got her problems, but just like in the Marine Corps, you don't give up, so you keep plugging along.
That's the attitude. That's the right attitude to have at all times.
You know the old story, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Absolutely.
Fellas, semper fi.
Well, Corporal, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it, and it's always a pleasure for me to talk to a living legend, and you are definitely that.
Stay healthy.
Thank you very much for your service and for coming on with us today. Thank you very much, sir.
That doesn't get you going and thank you and make you think that America is the greatest country on the earth, I don't know what to tell you. I really just don't, because Stanley is... That story was just so damn inspiring. Like, to think that that is what the Marine Corps' legacy is built on, is about gentlemen like Stanley Rubin. Like, what we... Everybody considers Marines to be tough, like it's the toughest branch, yada, yada, and it's because of men like him. Like, there's nothing that I did in my career that even remotely comes close to what Stanley did, and that's the reason why Marines have the reputation that we do. It's because of gentlemen like that. So I want to thank him again, even though he came on a long time ago, thank him again for coming on the show, because it will always be one of the favorite interviews that I've ever done. And we have one more ad read. It's Shady Rays. I've been talking about Shady Rays a lot. I've been going all over the place. I've been wearing them on the golf course. I love the Shady Rays, and you're going to love the Shady Rays too, because if you lose them like I do, you get a replacement set for free, and you can get two pairs for just $45. They also give 10 meals for every single order that's placed. They've donated over 4 million to date. Like, this is summertime. Everybody's going to be losing their sunglasses all over the joint. You might as well get some that you know you can get replaced. There's no reason to spend $200 on sunglasses when you get two pairs that look amazing for just $45. Go to ShadyRays.com and get the promo code ZERO, and you're going to get 50% off your first two pairs. That's such a great deal, and people are saying that they get there very quick. So if you're worried about they're not going to get here in time, people are getting them in less than a week. So make sure you get those orders in. So you can get those, save rounds alibis to myself. There is none. However, I will give a shout out to birds, because one of my favorite military stories of this week was that a bird in Florida flew into an A-10 gunship and caused three inert, they were like training bombs, to drop down on Florida. The pilot had no idea whenever the inert bombs fell off. They weighed about 25 pounds whenever they fell off. He had no idea, but they fell three places. Imagine what you would do if you were sitting in your backyard, just hanging out, and all of a sudden, three big old bombs fell off a plane into your backyard. You would probably shit yourself like I know I would. We'll be back with a full-out normal schedule next Tuesday. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We love you. Let's play. Bryn, let's play the national anthem on the way out. No, not national anthem. Find something really America and play that.